Hey, it's Paul Baines of GreatDad.com, and I'm here with my weekly series talking to men and dads about modern parenting. And I had an interesting take today talking to Kevin Thompson, who's an expert on relationships. So we may be talking a little bit more less about kids and a little bit more about how to keep the family intact by focusing on your marriage. But welcome, Kevin.
Hey, Paul, thanks so much for having me. And anybody that wants to be a better father, I'm ready to listen to and intrigued to talk with.
Okay, well, we'll get into that a little bit, but I think the real interest here may be in maintaining the relationship between the mom and the dad, because I think you'd agree that's kind of the bedrock of good parenting is providing a solid, secure, emotionally comfortable home for the kids.
I think that's a great point. And I do see marriage as an aspect of parenting. I don't in any way want to guilt anybody who has struggled with that or experienced divorce. My parents are divorced. They love me great. They're tremendous parents. It's no fault. It's just what happened. But at the same time, I think to no longer see marriage and parenting at odds, but instead to see them working together. I mean, think about one of the hot topics in education right now, adverse childhood experiences, the ACE score. Well, one of the 10 questions regarding an ACE score is, have your parents been divorced? And so that just goes to show the importance of creating a solid foundation for a child. And so the husband-wife relationship, that partner relationship is so integral to parenting.
Yeah, well, that really brings up an interesting question for me because my parents were separated. They were separated when I was two and divorced by the time I was, I think, four. And that's part of the reason why I do this. And it's such an important thing for me is to try to create fathers who are very present, both physically and emotionally. But also the whole idea of divorce has really been really something that I want to totally avoid in my life. And I wonder if that's part of what has motivated you to some extent.
Oh, there's no question about that. I mean, there's no question. How do you become a person who writes about marriage and parenting and things like that? I had a negative experience as a child, and I saw the pain that my parents went through. I see the consequences that are still lived out to that within our family. And I want to prevent other people from experiencing my own experience, what my parents went through, and want to assist others to the best of my ability.
Yeah, so I'm with you too. Like, no guilt or judgment on people who do get divorced, but I think both of our missions are a little bit tied up with trying to make sure people think long and hard, especially because of the factor of how it affects the kids, who should really be the center of your life if you decide to embark on this lifelong project called parenthood.
Oh, there's no question about that.
So on your website, you've got a bunch of facts, a bunch of resources. We'll talk a little bit about those a little bit later. But you cite some interesting statistics that I thought were interesting as you laid them out, like the most important year to work on your marriage is actually the year before you get married. And the first year of marriage is when everybody usually gets divorced. And I think there was a third one about year seven being like that's the benchmark of a marriage that's going to last a while. Have I got that kind of right?
Yeah, no, I think that's fair. So the most divorces, if you were to pick one year, when do most divorces happen? It is year one. That's just a statistical concept there. That's a little bit of an anomaly. Whenever you look at if a divorce is going to happen, the average divorce happens at year seven. The problems are felt at year five and experienced that most couples just don't know what to do about it. And they tend not to get help until it's too late. But what's interesting is those problems are actually present at year three, but the couples don't know it. And so think about what that means is a couple gets married. They tend to have a very high level of marital satisfaction. The honeymoon phase kind of wears off at 18, 24 months. And then by year three, the reality has hit. Well, that tends to be a time in which a lot of people begin to have children. And so not only are they now starting to experience some problems they didn't even know were present yet, but now you've had the added task of having a child. And on top of that, And think about what then happens over the next few years. They're not sleeping. They're having to learn new skills. I can't tell you how many times I've had a new dad tell me, I just want my wife back. And one thing I always say is you can't have her back, but you can join her where she is. And so think about this marriage-wise, the year with the highest drop-off of marital satisfaction is the first year of the first child. Okay. We understand that we're dads. We understand you're not sleeping, all those physical demands that are taking place. But what's interesting is that happens in 70% of couples, but 30% of couples don't feel that drop off. Why not? It really has to do with the husband and wife figuring out how to be good partners in the midst of that. So whenever I talk about marriage, I talk about friends, partners, and lovers. Those are the three roles you want to play. A friend is somebody who's always by your side, a partner is somebody who always has your back, and then a lover is somebody who sees you and loves you completely. And those qualities, friend, partner, and lover, are based off of trust, respect, and vulnerability. And so whenever you think about from a parenting standpoint, that really is a task of partnership. And many couples never figure out, they understand friendship whenever they first get married. Obviously, the physical aspect is there. Many couples never learn how to be good partners. And whenever you struggle in partnership, it begins to erode away into those other three areas. And that's why I think so many marital problems happen between years 3 and 7 when you're having kids.
Well, yeah, and I would probably add to that, that whole, it's the partnership and the lovers part too, because for men, especially that drop off of sex and after the first, you know, the honeymoon, the real life honeymoon is over, it has a big effect on the marriage. And then you add kids in the mix and a confusion over where the loyalties are to the kids or the marriage. It's a big ball of confusion that, like a lot of things in our society, are all mixed up with all these Hallmark images of what it should be like versus what the reality is. So what, when you talk about getting ready during the year before marriage, what kind of things are important if somebody was thinking about getting married? What would be the things that you'd want to make sure they understood or that they investigated before they got involved?
Yeah, well, I mean, one of the things we talk about is just the importance of premarital counseling, where what's happening is a couple, I prefer to do it with a professional counselor. A couple sits down with a professional counselor, and if nothing else, gets used to talking about the relationship with somebody else, and then specifically somebody else that understands what it takes to make a marriage work. Paul, one of the reasons I love married life these days is we've never lived in a day in which it's been so understood what it takes to make a marriage work. Mm-hmm. It is not just the idea of learning to use I statements and handling money properly and all those things. It really is this idea of having an emotional attachment and connection with another person. Now, one thing I say all the time about my wife, Jenny, is she loves me and she's for me. Those are two things that I know without a shadow of a doubt. And everything that she does, I interpret now through that lens of she loves me and she's for me. And then we have to learn, how do you communicate that? How do you nourish that? All those kind of things. And so what I would want a couple to do is not to race into marriage. I also don't personally want them acting like they're married before they are married. I think about this. The way some of the pesticides work, if you got a weed that you want to kill, you spray it on the leaves and it causes the leaves to grow really fast and the roots aren't able to grow. And that kills the plant. Mm-hmm. If you were to ask me, what's a prescription to kill a young relationship? I would say speed it up. In other words, have a physical intimacy and emotional intimacy that is far faster than the level of trust has actually been able to build. Because what you do then in that moment is you actually train yourself to wall off part of yourselves, that even as you're giving yourself to the other. And so one of the reasons I love premarital counseling, I just love a process, is if nothing else, I want the couple to slow down and then to methodically begin to walk through the big questions of life. I do a premarital class here in Northern California. One of the first things we'll do on the very first night is I will simply say this: who you marry matters. Is your partner a good person? Mm-hmm. Just that basic question. Are they good? Not are they perfect? Not are they attracted? None of those things. But just at the heart, are they good? Because I see a lot of couples who they kind of make excuses thinking my spouse is going to become something once we're married. And it's the old Bill Parcells line. Bill Parcells, the old football coach, somebody asked him one time why he's so successful in the draft. And he says, it's because I know one thing that other coaches don't know. You are who you are. He said, other coaches look at players and they think to themselves, oh, I can coach that out of them. I can teach them differently. Parcells says, I know I can't change who you are as a player. And so I draft people who they are. That's how we need to get married. We need to get married based on who people are, not who we think they might become.
And is that really a common problem with people who are getting married to people who are not, you know, good people, that it's obvious that they, you know, they have a drug problem, or they're a serial adulterer, or there's some, you know, something that's going on? Is it, you think in a lot of cases that really is that obvious? Because I think a lot of people, they have blinders on in terms of not only the big questions, but I would think also that there's a whole litany of other ones, like how do you feel about money, or how do you feel about children, or what is your parenting style going to be, or, you know, there's so many things that are wrapped up in a good marriage.
Well, I think the divorce rate would be cut in half immediately if simply there was no active addiction, abuse, or adultery.
Yeah.
That right there, just that right there. And so you should never marry somebody who is active in addiction, who is active in abuse, or who is active in adultery. You just shouldn't do it. And yet a lot of times people do move forward thinking once we tie the knot, those things will go away in some way. But I think the question goes deeper than that. It's not just the idea of, hey, they're a bad person because they have this addiction or something like that. It's not just that. It is also the idea of, is their heart turned toward you, or is it just turned toward self?
Right.
And that's where I think a lot of the excusing of bad behavior comes along, is there's a basic selfishness. I was talking to a counselor one time, Paul, and I said, hey, I have a theory that 10% of people should never get married just because they don't have the capability of actually being humble enough to think beyond themselves. Mm-hmm. And this counselor was in her 80s, had been doing this her whole life. She laughed at me and she said, oh, Kevin, you're wrong. The percent is much higher than that. And so
yeah.
I think that's a great point, that it's not just the idea of I'm a bad person as much as I know that Jenny is going to actively use her strengths for my benefit. That's what I mean by good, that there is an action and a behavior of that goodness that is going to be directed in my direction. And she knows I'm going to direct mine and hers as well. Not just, hey, this person's evil, although that exists as well.
Yeah, well, that's a really interesting point, and hard maybe for a lot of people to understand what that difference is in the bloom of a relationship, because there is that difference between what I think now some people call limerence, which is kind of like the crush or the early infatuation, and then what real love is. And especially with the current, you know, the current hookup culture, I think there are a lot of people out there, a lot of young people out there who don't know what the combination of sex and love is versus just pure individual pleasure. And then they have to figure that out at some point.
Yeah, the old author says that love is substance and lust an illusion, and only in the heat of passion do they mingle in confusion. And so that's one thing I do like about that first year. What I call it year negative one, so it's the year before the wedding ceremony, is to really kind of slow down and just recognize I'm at a real temptation right now to be deceived because of the emotion and the infatuation that's present. There's nothing wrong with that, but to recognize that and then bring in outside sources, professionals, family, friends, to bring in, to check us, to make sure that we are making wise decisions. Let's face it, Paul. If my friends, whenever I said I was going to get married, if they said, Kevin, this is a huge mistake, I would have slowed down.
Yeah.
I would have said, hang on, something's wrong here. We need other people to assist us, especially in making such big decisions.
Yeah, well, I'm with you there. In fact, that's one of the big things I think is missing in the marriage ceremonies of today, is that back in the day, there part of the ceremony was asking the community to be, you know, to be the people who bolster that marriage, that keep it going, that when it's rocky, they say, no, you keep on going. Unless, of course, there's some, you know, extraneous factor that we already mentioned. But that's somewhat missing, as well as the part I think a lot of people have been told, don't ever tell your friend, you know, that he's making a mistake, because if he ends up with her, then you'll be the, you know, the bad person. Whereas I think isn't that part of what a community is, and what part of friendship is helping people see that maybe in the during that infatuation stage?
No, absolutely. And I do think you need to be wise. I mean, you just don't just flippantly go out and say that. But to have that type of relationship, to begin to ask important questions. I mean, I ask couples all the time, why do you want to get married right now? And it's fascinating to me how a good number of couples have a good response, but every now and then you'll get a couple, they can't answer that. Well, if you can't answer why should you get married right now, you shouldn't be getting married. And so I think any community that can provide space for good questions, I think that's a powerful thing.
Yeah. Okay. So I would guess most of the people that were, who may be listening to this, are actually married and they may be suffering. I mean, all marriages, good or bad, have ups and downs. And there are days where you just want to say, I am getting in the car and driving to Canada. And that's normal. And I think we should make sure that people feel like if you have that feeling, it's the same way in a lot of parenting, go through your mind. That doesn't mean you necessarily act on that. You hopefully cooler heads prevail. But what advice do you have for somebody who's, you know, into that year three or five, and they know there are problems, hopefully they're not related to addiction or abuse, but that they, you know, they feel like she's going one way and I'm going another way, and we're never going to be able to reconcile the fact that she wants to live in New York and I want to live in Nevada, or, you know, something like that. That's that huge.
Yeah, I think here's the great news in which we live. There's never been a day in which there's been so many resources. So I think the key now is not to deny problems, to recognize that they're there, and then do the work that's necessary. And so it's going to mean learning skills. It's going to demand humility. But think about, for the average couple, when was the last time you read a book about marriage? When was the last time you had a mentor couple to help assist you? I read a text or a tweet from a psychologist just a couple of weeks ago. And one thing he said, a majority of the young couples I'm seeing right now actually don't need counseling. They need mentorship. And so to get a couple who's just a little bit further down the road than you, who's navigated these kind of challenges, to take vacation, to go on retreat, to go to a marriage conference. I mean, we do marriage retreats all the time. And I can't tell you, so a marriage retreat for a couple in serious trouble, a marriage retreat isn't going to solve it. You're going to need an intensive experience. You're going to need counseling. But for the average couple who's kind of, you know, hey, we're struggling a little bit, things aren't as good as we want them to be, something like a retreat where you have some intentional time can have a powerful impact. Here's the thing, Paul. The number one cause of divorce is not social media. It's not adultery. It's not money. It's apathy. Couples drift into behaviors, patterns, and rhythms that do not naturally nourish their connection. And over time, they lose sight of each other. They lose sight of themselves. And so the number one thing a couple can do for the relationship is to be intentional. Take intentional steps and actions to make your relationship better. Let's face it. I mean, Paul, this is the same thing we'd say about parenting. It's the same thing we're going to say about marriage. It's the same thing we're going to say about our diet, about exercise, about all these things. It is taking intentional steps. There are so many resources out there that a couple can take advantage of. If you're struggling at this moment, I would say at least do something and then see where it goes.
Yeah, I think men often get that knock, don't they, by women that, like, the wife is frustrated because the husband has gotten so apathetic that now he doesn't do anything. I mean, there aren't even any fights anymore. And she's like, just yell at me or have a reaction, say something, because you're just, you know, and that is really the death knell. Is it's almost worse than if you're squabbling all the time, because at least there is passion there and there's interest in trying to convince the other person. But when you've completely given up, it's hard to.
Oh, absolutely. I think marriages, they don't end in a shout. They tend to end in a whimper. And so it's the idea, it's not that I dislike you, it's that I feel nothing towards you at all. That's where the scary moment begins to come in. But here's the good news, even of that, is those emotions can come back. Restoration can take place. I could line up interview after interview of couples that I've worked with, and they would tell you, we were dead, but now we have a relationship we never thought was possible. And literally what happened is they did the work. And so if a couple is willing to do that, it's amazing what can take place.
Well, that is really good news, because I think a lot of people have heard, like, by the time you get to the marriage counseling, it's all over anyway. So why waste the money if you're at that point? But if you think that there is a possibility to come back, that's good news.
Oh, I think if a couple finds an emotionally focused therapist, EFT, right? Sue Johnson founded that. I think the success rate is about 70%. Oh. I think it's about 70% of couples that seek out counseling in that format, not only just stay together, but actually begin to thrive. And so think about this. I think that's a great point. That's one of the reasons my website is called Change the Odds, right? The average couple thinks their chance of marital success is 50-50. And the problem with that is if it's just the flip of a coin, then I'm less likely to do work, to make the effort, to change, because what's the point? But I honestly believe, Paul, that it, with just a few understandings, intentionality, those kind of things, I think the chance of marital success for a couple who's really willing to do the work is about 90-10. And think about that. If you have a 90% chance of success, you're far more likely to make the effort, do the work, go through the pain to experience that. So I think a couple needs to change their mindset that, you know what, if show me a couple where both of them are willing to do the work that's necessary, and very rarely will I actually show you counseling that doesn't work, occasionally, but very rarely. Generally, what happens is one of the spouses isn't willing actually to be vulnerable and to do the hard work.
Yeah. And of course, that 50-50 thing includes the serial divorcers I don't know what the actual number is for across all first marriages, whether it's more like 70% survive and 30% die. I don't know. It must be something like that.
I think it's 60. I think you have a 60% chance to make it to your 40th anniversary.
So how big an effect do you think also is either the cultural pressure or your milieu that tolerates or accepts divorce as an answer? Because I know you and I talked about both being kids from divorced parents, and I have for me, it's just that's not something I would ever do. I mean, I can imagine that there are circumstances where I would do it in case of, like you say, abuse or addiction or something like that. But lacking that, I have a total commitment to that. My wife is Asian American, and within her culture, that divorce is, you know, even less, you know, less of a possibility, is really looked down on. So we started out with an idea like we're gonna, you know, this is without, you know, all the other stuff outside, that this is not something we're entering into as, you know, maybe not kind of situation. How important do you think that is just having that mindset?
I think it's an important aspect. I do think there's some positives to where we are as a society compared to where we were 40, 50, 60 years ago. Women have choices. I think that's a positive thing. It used to be that couples might just stay together for the fact of staying together.
Sure, yeah.
And I don't think that's necessarily a pathway that we want to go down. At the same time, there are some negative consequences where literally for many people, whenever they come to a bad spot in their marriage, instead of doing the work to make it better, the only options they figure out is I can either accept this and live with it the rest of my life, or I can get out, when neither of those are really where I would point a person to. And so, and we do have this reality that divorce is contagious. There is a concept of it runs in circles and friendship groups. And that's why I think it's very important. I don't want you by any means to drop friends who go through it, but I think it is important to surround yourself with people who value marriage, who find it important in their lives, because then you're more likely to find it important in yours as well.
Yeah. Or at the very least to be aware that if a friend is going through the divorce, they're going to more tend to want you to join their club than watch you succeed in your marriage. And a lot of that, like you say, so much of this is intentional and it's awareness based and not just going through the motions. Yeah.
No, absolutely.
I guess my point about the commitment to the institution of marriage is that that sometimes can take you through periods of unhappiness on both parts, because there are these cycles. And if, you know, you hit a dip and you're ready to, you know, run away, that's different than saying, hey, I know, you know, things will be better. I also think that there's something that a lot of young people don't realize that is astoundingly valuable, that you probably know it. With your experience in marriage, is that on the other side, 20 years down the road, the relationship that you have with somebody who has been a witness to your life and has experienced all the things that you have, has raised your kids with you, there is something that is so valuable about that you can't even conceive of what that means in the first 5 years of marriage.
I think that's a great point. I have what I call the chart of marital satisfaction, and it is this idea that couples get married at this very high level. They're very happy, right? Year three hits, five, seven, there's a decline, you're having kids, you're exhausted. Then many couples experience what's called a second honeymoon. Literally what's happening there, a lot of times the kids are in elementary school, so you're sleeping and they still love you. Both of those things are happening. And then obviously for many couples, it plummets when the kids are teenagers. Not only your body's changing, life's changing, teenagers can be very demanding. But here's what's interesting to me. is if you take the average couple in their 60s who got married in their 20s, they have a higher level of marital satisfaction in their 60s than they had in their honeymoon years. And I think it shows, Paul, exactly what you're talking about, that value of love over a lifetime, of enduring through hard times, of learning new skills and doing all those things. And if you can push through all those times, there is nothing like walking beside somebody who you've experienced all these decades with. So I have a job here in Sacramento. I'm called a married life guy, right? And so I went to a drive-through one day, had a shirt on. The 20-something-year-old person working the drive-through counter sees the shirt and says, "Oh, are you like a counselor?" And I said, "No, we got people that do that, but that's not where I focus." I said, "Here's what I do." I said, "Have you ever thought about a couple in their 90s rocking out their last days, holding hands on the front porch of the nursing home? Have you ever noticed how you don't feel any pity toward them and you kind of want that?" I said, "It's my job to help people experience that." And what's amazing to me is that 20-year-old, immediately you could see the emotion in their eyes of how they wanted that. I think all of us have this desire to be known, valued, loved over a lifetime. And that's the potential that marriage presents to us.
Yeah, I totally agree. After having been married 27 years, there is a very much of a difference. And I guess it talks to your point about the friends, parents, and lovers part. The friendship thing, I think, some people, you know, it's the first couple of years, they're definitely my best friend. I always found that a kind of a hazy concept because the friendship gets married and then gets mixed up with the marriage part. But that does come at the later on in life when you have all this history in a different way. I don't know how to explain it, but I would advise young couples to try to get to that point, because in my marriage we've never been happier, more close, more affectionate, all those things that you want with a lot more ease than ever before.
Well, it just shows how those three roles, they might look different at different times throughout mm-hmm. life, but that basic concept of I have somebody who's by my side, who has my back, who sees me and loves me completely. If you have those three things in one person, you're going to be satisfied. And it just goes to show that in every stage of life, we need to figure out what does it mean to be a good friend, partner, and lover in this season of life. And if you will continue to pursue after that, then I think there's a very high likelihood that as you get to the later years of your life, you will have a very satisfying relationship and will have overcome many challenges and will have no regret that you're still together.
Right. So on the website, changetheodds.com, you have a quiz, which I took. I guess I was kind of in the 120 plus out of 150 range. I don't know if that's good or bad. But quizzes, you know, they're short and they're mostly for entertainment purposes. But there were some things in there that I thought were interesting. There were really provocative questions within that. And I tried to answer it as quickly and as, you know, just reaction basis I could. But what would you use that quiz for? What would be the indicators out of the quiz that people would take away?
Yeah, so we have a marital assessment on changetheodds.com, and it's 10 questions on friendship, 10 on partnership, 10 on intimacy. And I got together with a couple of counselors and we designed this. And it really is just meant to be an outside resource to quickly check where is our relationship, what are we strong at, and then what can we work on? And what I love about this assessment is, again, this is put together by professionals. So it asks some questions that maybe the average layperson would never consider mm-hmm. is important. And yet it doesn't take long for them to understand what it is. Let's look at the very first statement. So the very first statement, it's about friendship. And it's simply this. You're going to answer from 1 to 5, 5 meaning always true, 1 meaning never true, the truthfulness of this statement. I regularly have my spouse's attention and can easily get it when I need it. Okay, that issue of attention, I think, is the primary issue of marriage in 2024. You think about it, you're in San Francisco, I'm in Sacramento, triangled between the two of us. There are 4 or 5 extremely large companies spending billions of dollars every year trying to figure out how to get our attention so that they can sell to us and so they can actually sell us to others. And whenever you think about that, for every second of attention they get, who's losing that attention? Well, it tends to be the people that we love the most. And so, excuse me, think about the idea I regularly have my spouse's attention. That's not a high bar. I'm not saying 24/7, 365. I'm just saying there is a rhythm in our lives in which I know maybe it's over dinner time, maybe it's bedtime, maybe it's when we wake up. For my wife and I, we take a walk about every other day, and we just know during that 45 minutes, we're going to have each other's attention. So I regularly have it and can easily get it when I need it, which means if I'm in distress, there is a communication pattern set in place that will get my spouse's attention, and she will drop whatever she is doing and leverage her resources for my benefit. Now, get this, Paul. 85%, we've had maybe 5,000 people take this. 85% of the people who answer this assessment cannot answer that as a five.
Wow.
Well, okay. That's a problem. If you do not regularly have your spouse's attention and cannot easily get it when you need it, your friendship is going to suffer. And as your friendship begins to suffer, you're not going to be as good of a partner as you can be. The intimacy is not going to be as good as it can be. And it's going to have an erosive effect. But if we were to go out on the street right now and ask 100 people, 1,000 people, tell me the top five issues regarding marriage right now, what are they going to say? They're going to say communication. They're going to say money. They're going to come up with, they're not going to say attention. So what experts would say is the number one issue of our day, the average person does not even see the connection to the relationship. Now, the moment I explain it, they see it. And so what I love about this assessment is it causes you to think about some things that you wouldn't think about otherwise.
Yeah, well, and it has some massive repercussions in the family too, because that's all one of the big things that's pulling away from the family and the connection between our kids too, is that even if they're not on their phones, you're on your phone, and there's that lack of communication and just awareness and that of the ups and downs and the needs and drivers of everybody in your family. I mean, I think it's huge.
Yeah, and that's just one question out of 30. And so that's why I like that assessment. Then you can see a score and you can look at it. And what I always recommend for couples to do is, it's not so much where you score, because no relationship is a number. It's just the idea of go back in and say, hey, you know what? Here's the question that I was most intrigued by. And let's talk about that. And if you go to changetheodds.com, I actually have videos, 3 or 5 minute videos, that begin to break down each question of why I ask it. Of if you got a low score, here's what you can do. If you got a high score, here's what you can do. And it's again, we're talking about intention. It's a great way to start taking small intentional steps toward a better relationship.
Yeah, I love that. I mean, I know I said it was kind of an entertaining, the idea of a quiz is entertaining, but you do drill down with answers and discussions on each one of those topics. And I found the questions really very different, as you say, than what you would traditionally think of as indicators of So moving this toward parenting, is there anything in the relationship studies that you've done, the work you've done with couples that says something important about how we relate to our kids? And maybe it is some of these basic things like attention.
Yeah, I think obviously those things play in, because a basic concept now of having an intimate connection with others, not physically intimate. I'm talking about an emotional intimacy. Many of those play in the exact same way. And the idea of how our spouse and our children can both trigger our unresolved past if we haven't dealt with it in some way. But my first thought on that, Paul, is so my latest book is called Stay in Your Lane. And within Stay in Your Lane, I talk about what I call the CIA. And it's a question of, what do you control? What do you influence? And what do you accept? So I want to control everything that belongs to me. I want to influence what belongs to other. And then I want to accept the things that really just life kind of throws my way. And as long as I'm doing that, my anxiety stays at bay. I tend to love well, relationships are working well. But what I tend to do, I'm sure you don't do this, Paul, but what I tend to do is I tend to ignore those things that are actually mine, my own attitude, effort, energy, inputs, all those kind of things. And I tend to fixate what belongs to others and try to control now what belongs to others. And then I oftentimes live in denial of the things in life that I really can't change. And the byproduct of that is my anxiety rises, my friction in relationships grows. I get very frustrated. I tend to get stuck in some way. So my overarching parenting advice is simply this: what do you control? What do you influence? And what do you have to accept? So I got a 15-year-old, 19-year-old. 18-year-old has Down syndrome. You're not changing that. You have to accept it. And as long as you live in denial of it or in despair of it, you're going to feel stuck. But the moment you say, this is reality and I'm going to accept it, now, what do I control? I'm going to control those things. And then how can I influence? And specifically, you think about what's going on here. When my kids were first born, I almost controlled everything.
Yeah.
But every single day that they live, I have to take things out of the what's mine category and put it into the what's theirs category.
Yeah.
And so my son is 15. I influence him, but I don't control him. And I think so much of parenting problems comes in as we as parents either are not controlling what we actually can, or we're trying to control things that we actually should only be influencing or trying to accept. Control, influence, accept. You need to know the CIA because the CIA knows you.
Yeah, I that's really good wisdom, because I think it's a constant, it's all part of this being present, being intentional. I know those overused words, but they just sum up so much of what we're talking about, because the kids are growing at this rate and they're developing and evolving. And you have to temper those three dials based on where they are. When they're two, they're, you know, you have 100% control. When they're five, you have a little bit less. And when they're teenagers, and you know, I have kids in college, and you know, something like a tattoo, which would have been not going to happen, now is something I have no control over. So do I accept it and let it go? Or do I let my son, you know, think that I love him less because he, you know, he did something that I didn't want to do? And I'd be foolish to think that I have any control over him now. Hopefully I had influence earlier and, you know, control early on, so he made it through his early years. But that is, I love that paradigm. It's a really good way to think about it.
Yeah, and my wife and I use it all the time. We literally will just take a sheet of paper, draw a couple lines, make three columns, and ask the question, what's mine? We say it this way: what's mine, what's theirs, what's God's? Okay,
yeah.
We control what's ours, we influence what's theirs, we accept what's God's. And it's amazing to me how when you put things in those categories, it shows you your next step.
Yeah, the serenity prayer is a real thing. And if we could all internalize that a little bit better, maybe we'd all be a lot better off, because it is this thing that devils us continuously about our level of happiness or a level of conflict. Well, this has really been interesting conversation, and we don't usually talk about the marriage, but I, with you, think that it's really one of the bedrocks of a strong family and strong, resilient kids. So this has been great. Your website is changetheodds.com. You've written three books, one that is more on parenting, which that's the middle book, right?
That's called Fearless Families. And so in Fearless Families, we just talk about the difference between what I call the home of the afraid and the home of the brave. And so whenever fear rules us, we tend to act in a certain way, whereas when love rules us, we act in a different way. And so it kind of tells the story of my son's anxiety and how that revealed my own anxiety, and then how we kind of dealt with that.
Yeah, I know. Boy, well, that's a whole nother podcast. And then you've got Friends, Partners, and Lovers, which you talked about, and then Stay in Your Lane. One other thing that I just wanted to ask you about is on the website, you talk about advising the people you work with to do some sort of marital retreat or an inventory every 2 years. Can you just touch on that for just a second? Because that's kind of intriguing.
Yeah, one of the things we talk about with Change the Odds is I think about, what do I need to do to stay in shape? Basically, I need to work out about 3 days a week. And if I can do that, I will maintain good shape. So for the average couple, what do they need to do to stay in kind of marital shape? And so my concept is that basically every other year, they need to take some intentional time to go through good content in the midst of good community. And if they will do that, I think the average couple will maintain a good shape. So my encouragement is always this: take the odd year of your anniversary date. And so my wife and I next year will have been married 25 years. And so next year, that's an odd year. Let's take that odd year, and then we are going to intentionally either get into a small group, kind of work through a marriage book together, or we're going to go on a marriage-specific intensive retreat in order to just ask the big questions of what's going on. And I think if you will take the odd year of your marriage year and work on your marriage, I think you can change the odds of your marriage.
Yeah, I've heard about this concept in some other areas, not necessarily a retreat, but taking time to take the inventory on two or three major categories and just having a real frank conversation. You know, is our sex life good? Is our communication good? Whatever those topics are, and so that you feel like you're somewhat in alignment with with how your satisfaction is and the different parts of the relationship. Fascinating stuff. Okay, so I'd like to end these conversations with three questions. They're not going to be on relationships. They're always about the kids. So the first question is, did you have a mantra when your kids were little that kind of kept you from blowing your top when you got really frustrated?
Yeah, I kind of did. So whenever it came time for bedtime, we got to a point where I would always put our son to bed. My wife would always put our daughter to bed. And the one thing I would tell Silas every night, the last words I would speak to him were, "Buddy, I love you. You're going to be a mighty man one day." And so I think I thought about that oftentimes when he would frustrate me or I would frustrate myself. Hey, it's okay. He's going to be a mighty man one day. And so that's just the life I wanted to speak into him.
Oh, I really love that part, especially about the consistency of the love, even though it may be a difficult situation, and both of you probably are stressed, and yet you still are affirming this thing that is everlasting and permanent and isn't going to go away because of something small, because later on it'll be something big, and they need to know that. They need to know that they have one refuge in the world, and that's within their family. The second question is, do you have any advice for young fathers just in general? Maybe it is relationship specific.
Yeah, I think it would, again, come back to the CIA. Just in every aspect of your life, but specifically in parenting, come back to that idea of figuring out what do you control. You actually control far more than you realize. And to exercise that agency appropriately will remove any sense of helplessness, but you don't control everything. And so, what is it that you can influence in life? And then, what is it that you need to accept? And if you will daily just get through the model of working through the CIA, in parenting, in marriage, in work, in life, I honestly think that you will worry less, you'll love more, and you'll get things done.
And then finally, do you have a challenge for dads for this coming week that's something that they can keep up top of mind or they can challenge them to do during the coming week?
Yeah, I would say pay attention. And so create in your calendar right now some time in which you're going to intentionally give your full attention to your spouse and then another time to each child that you have, and then see the impact that that brings.
That really is interesting. I'd love to hear feedback from dads who do that for a week and whether that's something new for them if they try to do that versus, just going through the motions, which I think it's very tempting to do that, especially during the real stressful early parenting years where you're working so hard and everything else. Well, this has been really a fascinating conversation. I really appreciate the time, Kevin. The website again is changetheodds.com, and you can find a lot of the resources there, and we'll put that in the show notes. So that's good. You can find my coaching at greatdad.com/coaching, or what I think is really important is also within the control influence acceptance part is controlling or being able to change or having a control over the only thing that you do have in certain cases, which is your reaction to things that you cannot change. And you can learn more about my 7-week program about how to realize when that's happening and how to learn how to find positive responses at greatdad.com/PQ. Okay, thanks a lot, Kevin. Take care.
Hey, thanks for having me, Paul. Thank you.